Welcome to The Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth, best-selling author and co-creator of PaleoParents.com, where we focus on real-life solutions for families seeking health.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times best-selling author and creator of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
Welcome back, listeners. Yet again, we are here. And this week, it's not just you and I, Sarah. We have not been doing a lot of guests lately. And so it's pretty exciting that we have not just any guest, but a pretty excellent guest who's back for a repeat performance.
Are you saying you're tired of talking to just me?
Maybe. But also, you hung up on me earlier, so it's not a one-way
that
street.
That was Skype. I did not touch anything. I promise. There's no way for me to prove this whatsoever. Right. It'll have to be my word against Skype's. But we do have a very exciting guest. I am really excited because our guest today is one of just my favorite people in the paleo movement. He's a thought leader, and he's a person who is always, everything he says is completely grounded in science and just logic. And just a little bit of like, can everyone just calm down kind of overall voice. And that is something that I think is so important in this community right now. So welcome, Chris Kresser. Thank you for coming back on the podcast.
Thank you, Sarah and Stacey, for the very gracious introduction. I hope I can live up to it. And it's always a pleasure to be with you both.
Well, if you get hysterical and start ranting and raving about non-sciencey things, all of my intro will have been proven wrong.
That seems unlikely, but we'll see.
But I've been waiting for over 5 years for someone to prove Sarah wrong in some capacity. So you'll have my thumbs up.
All right. Maybe I'll give it an extra try then.
I am not going to say anything now that could be possibly. Yeah, no. That's going to go.
Well, Chris, you have joined us this week in particular of all times because you have a new book coming out, and we would love for you to talk a little bit about that. I think it's a really interesting new approach to what people might think of. They've heard endlessly about paleo books or whatever the case may be. And I think we've got a completely different approach here, which I think is fantastic. And if maybe I could just kind of give people a little why Sarah and I are big fans of yours, for those of you who might not know. Chris's can be found at chriskresser.com, and he has been practicing functional medicine for as long as I've been part of paleo. I guess you can tell us more about your bio. And I first found you through Rob Wolf's podcast, which at the time you totally called him out on fish oil
podcast.
Yep.
I remember that one.
And I was like, I love that this guy just called him out. And what I loved even more was that Rob Wolf was like, this is really legit information you're sharing with me. I'm going to look into it. And then he actually changed his recommendations based on it. And that was one of the reasons that I personally found paleo to be something that I really respected, because I looked at two thought leaders and neither one of them were totally stuck on what the concepts were that they were preaching, and were able to admit kind of, oh, well, this thing that I've been recommending isn't the right thing. Do this other thing. So anyway, that's kind of my background. And that was at least, I don't know, six years ago or something.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that was a good while ago now.
Yes. Anyway, so why don't you tell us what you've been up to since? I know you actually published a book earlier and you were on our podcast, so I don't think we need to go back into that. Matt can put that previous episode in the show notes. But kind of, I mean, what you've been up to lately and what your kind of current focus is on would be fantastic, just to kind of catch up.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thanks again for that. So my first book was really about taking back your own health, but this book is about taking back healthcare. I think my progression over time has been first dealing with my own complex chronic illness, and then realizing that what I learned in that process could help other people. And so, you know, going back to school to study to formalize that, and, you know, opening a practice where I was treating patients individually. And then at some point I realized, well, this is fantastic and I want to continue to do this work, but the number of people that I can impact in a one-on-one fashion is limited. Even if I hire additional clinicians to work at the clinic, which we have, we're now up to 5 clinicians, a nurse practitioner, health coach, and 2 nutritionists at the clinic. We've grown considerably, tripled in size in the past 3 years alone. Still, you know, it's limited, right? And it will always be limited. And so I realized that the biggest impact I could make would be to train healthcare practitioners in the approach that I use. And so a couple of years ago, I launched Kresser Institute in order to do that. And we've trained almost 400 clinicians from all over the world in functional medicine and ancestral diet and lifestyle and a collaborative practice model. But then I realized, in doing that work, that this message needs to get out on a much broader scale. And I started to think on a more societal or even global level in terms of the threat of chronic disease, more so even than, you know, more than the individual level, more than the sort of community level, and more than even the practitioner level. I started to think about it in terms of social change that needs to happen, because the truth is chronic disease really threatens not only to erode our quality of life and to shorten our lifespan, which it most definitely is, it actually threatens to completely destroy the fabric of our society and bankrupt us as a government. If things continue at their current pace, the U.S. is projected to be financially insolvent by the year 2035, which is in most of the people who are listening to the show's lifetime. So that means we might not even
lifetime, not even like lifetime.
Absolutely.
Or like, retirement lifetime.
Yes. Yeah. So we're actually, this might sound overly dramatic, but I don't think it is. We're actually talking about the very survival of our country and the health of future generations. So when I began to realize that it was, you know, that big of a deal, I felt like I needed to do something to get this message out on a wider scale. And, you know, I still think a book is the best way to do that. So here we are.
So the book is called Unconventional Medicine. I don't know if you actually said that. And it comes out, I'm just going to add the plug for you.
I'm terrible at that. Oh, yeah, it has a title. Yeah, right.
It's called Unconventional Medicine, and it comes out November 7th, which means it's book twins with my book.
Cool. When is your, is it literally the same day?
Literally the same day.
Wow, I didn't even know that.
So I do want to encourage our listeners to go get it. I think it has really great information in it for both the practitioner and the patient. Like, I think it really pulls those people together and kind of gets everyone on the same page. So I definitely recommend our listeners go pre-order, because as they've heard me saying for last month, pre-orders are really important. Go pre-order. And I noticed it's on sale on Amazon. So it's also a great price. And we'll definitely put links in the show notes for anyone who wants to sort of bookmark this for later. But I did kind of want to go back and talk to Chris while we have you on the show about functional medicine in general, because I think this is still a concept that feels very foreign for people who have only ever gone to see a doctor when they've felt sick. Right. And this idea of even just preventative medicine beyond your doctor saying, oh, you should eat healthy and exercise, right? Like, there's this, you know, 30-second soundbite of what that might actually be, and then you're sent on your merry way and you don't see your doctor again unless you're doing a yearly physical or you have some kind of illness or some kind of symptoms that are, you know, undiagnosed and you're feeling terrible. And I think I've been working with a functional medicine specialist for about 4 years, and it's been the thing that that got me that extra, like, diet and lifestyle changes made a huge difference in my health, but it didn't make me all the way better. It didn't take me to the place I wanted to be. And it was functional medicine that took me the rest of the way. And so it's something I feel very passionately about personally as a medical model. And I would like to just kind of take a step back and have you maybe share how you got into functional medicine in the first place, while also taking the opportunity to define what that approach is.
Sure. Yeah. So I got very sick in my early 20s. I was traveling around the world and I was on a small island in Indonesia, and I got multiple parasite infections simultaneously, which took me to the curb. And while I recovered somewhat quickly from the acute effects of that illness, it really evolved into a decade-long journey back to health. And along the way, I learned in a painful, repetitive fashion that conventional medicine was really not set up to deal with chronic, complex, multi-system illness. You know, our medical model evolved during a time when the top challenges that we faced were all acute problems like infection or trauma or emergency. Back in 1900, the top three causes of death were typhoid, tuberculosis, and pneumonia, all acute infectious diseases. And other reasons that people would go see a doctor were also acute, like a broken bone or an appendicitis or a gallbladder attack. And treatment was pretty straightforward. You know, is the doctor put the bone in a cast or would remove the appendix or the gallbladder. And then later, once antibiotics were developed, would prescribe an antibiotic. One problem, one doctor, one treatment, right? But fast forward to today, it's a totally different landscape. The 7 of the 10 top causes of death are chronic disease, and 86% of our healthcare dollars go toward treating chronic disease. And then when you have somebody like me who's got really complex presentation and chronic problem that doesn't lend itself well to that one problem, one doctor, one treatment approach, they just don't know what to do. And it's not an issue with individual doctors. Almost every doctor I saw along the way was a caring person who really did their best to help. It's just that they didn't have the resources or tools or even the perspective or the paradigm to be able to help me. So, you know, functional medicine is a systems biology approach to treating disease. And, you know, when I talk about it to people who aren't familiar with it, I like to use an analogy just to make it simple. So if you have a rock in your shoe and it's making your foot hurt, in the conventional model, you get a diagnosis of foot pain. Actually, they would make it sound fancier than that, but essentially it would be telling you that it would say foot pain, but it would use probably a Latin word for foot. You know,
diatritis.
Yeah, exactly. Dolores or something. And then you would be prescribed a painkiller of some kind, ibuprofen. And certainly that would help with the pain. But wouldn't it be better to just take off your shoe and dump out the rock? And that's really what functional medicine is in a nutshell. It's a process that is designed to get to the root cause of disease rather than just suppressing symptoms with drugs, which is the focus of the conventional model. And that leads to much more effective and longer lasting treatments, and actually creates the potential for a cure rather than creating patients for life. So let's use an example. If you go to the doctor and you have high blood pressure or you have high cholesterol, what's going to happen?
They're going to want to put you on a statin right away.
Right. You'll be on a statin or you'll be on a blood pressure medication. And if you ask the doctor how long you're going to be taking that drug, what will they say?
They'll say the rest of your life.
That's exactly right.
So, we did not script this ahead of time, guys,
no,
by the way.
We didn't.
This was not pre-planned.
And I'm sure everyone out who's listening answered the same. You know, everybody knows the deal. So that creates patients for life, right? It creates a situation where people are taking medications to suppress symptoms for the rest of their life. And then inevitably, what happens? You know, the blood pressure medication that they're taking causes other symptoms or side effects. And then you go to the doctor and you complain about those side effects, and what happens? You get prescribed another drug to deal with those side effects. Yep. And then you get on this treadmill, which explains why, you know, I forget the exact statistic, but I think 40% of people over 65 years of age are taking five or more medications. You know, it just gets to be ridiculous. And it doesn't have to be this way. And this is the promise of functional medicine, where we look, if we go back to that same example, if a patient comes in to see me and they have high blood pressure and or high cholesterol, the first question I'm going to ask is why. You know, it's not normal for blood pressure or cholesterol to be really high. It's not how our bodies are designed. So we have to ask why. And then we look to diet and lifestyle and behavior. That's always the starting place, because those are the primary drivers of chronic disease. And then from there, if that's not enough, as you were saying in the introduction, Sarah, sometimes we need to look at other pathologies, you know, which are mechanisms that give rise to disease, and we can address those. And so we approach it instead of from the outside in, starting with the symptoms and suppressing those to help a patient manage a disease after it's already occurred. We start from the inside out, where we look at the diet, lifestyle, behavior, and the pathologies, and then we address those so that the patient can get well and stay well without taking unnecessary drugs for the rest of their life. So that's kind of functional medicine in a nutshell.
So I think the question, sorry, Stacey, can I ask one more question?
No, because you're going to change the topic, Sarah. Mm. So I think what's fascinating is earlier today, I actually went to an actual doctor for a foot problem.
That's so awesome.
I twisted my ankle. Yeah.
Not awesome that you have a foot problem, but yes. Awesome.
Unfortunately, I couldn't just take the rock out of my shoe. But I twisted my ankle yesterday on a farm.
Did you have podiatritis?
No, it's, okay. I mean, it was foot pain. Yeah. But you know, what's interesting is I don't go to any doctor regularly. I don't really see anyone functionally or, conventionally. I see functional when I need to, essentially. So I was talking to the doctor, and the doctor's like, well, are you taking any medication? And I was like, no. He's like, no, I mean, like, you know, Medicaid, you know, like, are you taking something daily?
I'm like anything, like Advil, you know, anything.
No. And he's like, well, here I am, like, with this foot that is, you know, like, potentially broken. It ends up being a sprain. And he's like, okay, well, what kind of, you know, pain medication are you on? And I'm like, well, I have autoimmune diseases, so I don't like taking anything if I don't really need to. I've just been icing it. And they look at me like I've got a third
alien.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay. You know, and it was kind of a good reminder that, you know, some people, I guess the majority of people, if that's the expected response, are jumping on that kind of stuff. And Sarah and I talk about all the time, these are life-saving techniques that we are fortunate to have. And there was a period of time where, when you look at like the chronology of human life, where we had an optimized lifespan because it incorporated healthy lifestyle and living, active lifestyle, so to speak, and not yet modern processed foods. And it also had integrated things like soap and not drinking from places where we put our bodily fluids. And that made like such a huge difference in the lifespan of humans. And yet now we're on this decline. And I think what is really interesting to me is this idea of more and more conventional doctors starting to see the same thing. And I don't know if it's just the bubble that I'm in, but I know personally in my life several doctors, MDs, who are paleo or who adopt it. And I don't know if you know Tribe Beyond Blessed, who used to be, oh my goodness, I can't remember their name. But anyway, Anthony and Katrina are both MDs. And so, and they live in the DC area, and I'm with them pretty frequently. And it's fascinating to hear a doctor's perspective on the expectations of, you know, most patients and what they're willing to even hear or be open to. And I think, I know Sarah has another kind of follow-on question, but I guess I kind of wanted to open Pandora's box, because as you look at training more conventional medicine doctors into learning some of the functional approach, which I think is really kind of ultimately what the book aims to do, is to, you know, help people figure out ways to remove the rock before giving pain medication. The question is really, are people ready to even hear that from their doctors? Because I know when I go to, you know, the kids' doctors, it says right on the sign, like, you don't need antibiotics for a cold. You know, like, even the doctors are telling you that, but people are still asking for it, you know?
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, so that's a great question. There are a lot of ways to answer that. So one is that in the book, I advocate for a model with three components. One is functional medicine, which we talked about. Two is an ancestral diet and lifestyle, which I know you've talked about a lot on your show, and you both advocate. And three is a collaborative practice model. And that piece actually addresses your question, Stacey, because what we know now is that information is not enough to promote behavior change in all but a small percentage of the population. And we're talking about a single digit percentage and probably a very low single digit percentage. Which, what I mean by that is, if you just telling someone what to do, it's not going to work in the vast majority of cases. That's not how behavior change works. We have lots of research now on behavior change that and how to actually facilitate that in people that shows that they need more support in most cases. So if a doctor just says, hey, you need to eat better, patient's going to leave the office and do nothing. But if the doctor, you know, if you, going back to our example of high cholesterol, if you went to the doctor and the doctor said, okay, you've got high cholesterol, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to set you up with a health coach, and they're going to, you know, come to your house and do a pantry clean out, and they're going to take you to the grocery store and show you how to buy these good foods, and they're going to give you some recipes and meal plans and help you get started cooking there. And then we're going to set you up with a gym membership and a trainer at the gym. They're going to help you, you know, adopt an exercise plan, and your insurance company is going to pay for all of this. That would be a totally different scenario than it is now, where the doctor just happens to mention, you know, follow a healthy diet and lifestyle, and then there's absolutely no support provided for that in the system, and there's no reimbursement provided for that. So that's number one. Number two is, in the same way that we've trained doctors to focus on suppressing symptoms with drugs, we've trained patients to expect that too. We're the only country other than New Zealand in the whole world that allows direct-to-consumer drug advertising. And the result of that has been that patients will often show up at the doctor asking for certain drugs that aren't even appropriate for their condition. And research has shown that a lot of times doctors will eventually just cave in and prescribe them because the patient just, you know, badgers them until they do. And so the change needs to happen on a lot of different levels, and I'm certainly not arguing that this is going to happen overnight, but I am arguing that it will happen one way or another, whether we take the easier route and do it proactively, or whether we do it because our healthcare system is just crumbling under the burden of chronic disease. Because the elephant in the room that nobody mentioned during the healthcare debate this year is that, you know, the healthcare debate was focused on insurance, health insurance, but health insurance is important and we need to have that discussion, but we also need to recognize that health insurance is not the same as healthcare. Health insurance is a method of paying for healthcare, okay? And the important point that nobody talked about is that there is no method of paying for healthcare that will be sufficient in the face of rising rates of chronic disease as we're seeing now, period. Doesn't matter if government is paying for it, corporations are paying for it, or individuals are paying for it. Nobody will be able to afford treating chronic disease, when one in two Americans has chronic disease now, today, one in four Americans has multiple chronic diseases, almost 30% of kids have a chronic disease, which is up from just 13% in 1994, not very long ago. I mean, I was in college then. It was in my adult life. That's 25 years ago. This dramatic increase in the prevalence of chronic disease is going to sink our healthcare system unless we take action to prevent and reverse it. That's just a reality. And, you know, we can either see that and accept it and take action, or we can wait for the time when we're in a place where we have no other choice. I would prefer the former, and that's part of what the reason that I wrote this book, but we're going to get there one way or another. That's the key point.
So I had almost the flip side of that coin from Stacy's question, which was the conventional medicine doctors who are really stuck in that model. And I think my understanding is part of it is how our healthcare system is set up, where, you know, insurance companies have a fair bit of say in terms of what's covered and what's not covered. So doctors don't have as much autonomy as they need to be able to actually dig deeper when a patient comes in, or spend more time with them, for example. But I was sort of, my question was the flip side of that, of how, what is the elevator pitch for a conventional practitioner to start changing their practice to be more of a sort of root cause focus?
Well, there are lots of ways to look at that too. So one is that many doctors now are extremely dissatisfied. I just got back from San Diego, where I was doing a presentation at the Academy of Integrative Health and Medicine conference. And, you know, these are a group of people who are already, you know, have seen the limitations of conventional medicine and have taken some action to, you know, step outside of that model. And yet I asked them these same questions I'm about to share with you, the responses of conventional doctors, and they were largely the same, actually. They track pretty closely. So 63% of doctors are pessimistic about the future of medicine. 14% feel they have the time they need to provide the highest standard of care.
That's not a very high percentage.
That's not a high percentage. 49%, almost half, often or always experience feelings of burnout. 54% rate their morale as somewhat or very negative. And half have thought of quitting medicine. So doctors are not happy, right? They're dissatisfied. The average primary care visit in the U.S. now is between 8 and 12 minutes. The average number of patients that a doctor, primary care practitioner has on their patient roster is 2,500. That's insane. It's, you know, I don't know any doctor who thinks that's a really good idea, and feels satisfied or rewarded or feels like they're truly helping patients in the way that they want to do that. And so from a practitioner perspective, the biggest pitch for this model that I'm advocating is a much more meaningful and rewarding way of practicing medicine. And for many people, getting, you know, reclaiming that original purpose that pushed them into medicine in the first place, to truly transform people's lives, to have the satisfaction at the end of the day that comes from knowing that you really did make a big difference in the patient's life, and you know that you're putting them on a path that's going to lead to real transformation, instead of just, you know, handing out a drug and knowing that they're going to be back soon. So I think that's the biggest, that's the thing that resonates most with most doctors that are still working in that conventional model. You know, doctors in 1970 earned the same wage in inflation-adjusted dollars as doctors today, and yet today's doctor sees twice the number of patients. So there's just been a steady increase in this, the number of patients seen on a day-to-day basis, and it's led to this kind of factory system of medicine that isn't serving patients, but it also isn't serving doctors. And just about any doctor you talk to will agree with that. I mean, there may be some disagreement about what the solution is, but there's not very much controversy about that.
So I don't want to get super embroiled in politics, but at the same time, I'm going to ask a, you know, policy related question,
sure,
which is when so much of this is sort of dictated from government policies, what can people or doctors do to help affect change? And what kind of policy changes do we need to see to be able to get to a point where patients with chronic illness are getting real meaningful medical intervention that's actually helping them to reverse or prevent the progressive decline, right, that might normally be associated with their chronic illnesses, and also give people who are currently healthy the information that they need to maintain that?
Yeah, well, we could talk for several hours about that. It's a very complex problem. If we use an analogy, the disease that our healthcare system is suffering from is multifactorial. It's chronic and it's complex, and it's multi-system. You know, just like most chronic diseases. So we have a problem with misaligned incentives. You know, insurance companies, for example, benefit when healthcare expenditures rise. So that's a disconnect, right? Because it's not in the insurance company's best interest to limit expenditures because they don't profit as much in that scenario. So that's why we have this continually growing, bloated system, because that's the incentive for the insurance companies. 2/3 of medical education are medical studies are sponsored by pharmaceutical companies. We have broken payment models. We've got, 2/3 of medical research. I said education. I just want to make that clear. You know, we have a medical paradigm, as I mentioned, that doesn't fit the challenge that we face now, which is chronic disease. And we've got massive conflicts of interest all through medicine. So I don't claim to have the answers to all of these problems, but I think that the change needs to happen on both a local level. It will start in a kind of grassroots way with local clinics like mine embracing this approach and people having a lot of success with it. And then we have other examples on a bigger scale, like Cleveland Clinic Center for Functional Medicine, which was started by Dr. Mark Hyman, a pioneer in functional medicine. Cleveland Clinic is a prestigious institution that's known all over the world to be on the forefront of the newest trends in medicine. And they have invested tens of millions of dollars in the Center for Functional Medicine. When it opened, it was small and they quickly outgrew that space. And now they're they've taken over the entire second floor of the Glickman Tower, which also houses Cleveland Clinic Urology and Cardiology, which are number one in the world. And they've got a wait list of 2,600 patients from 9 countries around the world. And they've grown to 16 practitioners and over 50 employees by the end of this year. So that's a phenomenal success story, and it's getting a lot of attention. Then we have primary care groups like Iora Health, which is a group based in the Rocky Mountain area, and they're reversing type 2 diabetes using health coaches. So we're seeing a lot of these successful examples pop up. And then, you know, I think the change will be, quite frankly, slowest to happen on the federal level, because there's the enormous weight of that bureaucracy and the divisive political climate that we find ourselves in today. And the fact that, as I mentioned, we're not even having the right conversation yet. You know, we're still preoccupied with the health insurance debate, which is, again, important. I don't mean to diminish the importance of that, but what I don't think people either haven't realized or haven't been willing to admit that that's in some way, I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg, really. It's the tip that we see. But what we're not acknowledging is that there's no method of paying for care that will be adequate in the face of rising rates of chronic disease like we're seeing. And so eventually that recognition will come. And when it does, I want to go back to something I was taught, the example I gave earlier with the patient who goes into the doctor hypothetically with high cholesterol and then is assigned a health coach and a gym membership and a trainer, and that's paid for. That might seem like a pipe dream and ridiculous, and it is from the perspective of our current system. But let me tell you why that's not actually so far-fetched and why that would be probably far more cost-effective than our current method. If you think about type 2 diabetes, which we now know 100 million Americans have either prediabetes or type 2 diabetes, and 88% of those with prediabetes don't even know they have it. And the average amount of time it takes for a person with type 2 diabetes with prediabetes to progress to full-fledged type 2 diabetes is just 5 years. So without intervention, in a very short period of time, we're going to be in very, 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 very big trouble, to put it lightly. And because it costs $14,000 a year to treat a single patient with type 2 diabetes. Now, those costs are often not apparent to consume, you know, to patients, because the healthcare system is paying for many of those costs. But that doesn't mean they're not being incurred and paid for somewhere by somebody. And it doesn't even mean that the patient isn't paying for them indirectly in the form of insurance premiums and taxes and other costs. So imagine a hypothetical patient that is diagnosed with type 2 diabetes at age 40, and that's totally plausible. I mean, the age of diagnosis is dropping more and more every year. We have kids 8 years old being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. So they're diagnosed at 40, and let's say they live until 85 years old, which is also plausible given our heroic medical technology that can keep people alive for a lot longer than they typically would otherwise live. So that's a cost of $630,000 to the healthcare system for that single patient with that single disease. But of course, they won't just have that single disease. They'll have other diseases and comorbidities. They might at some point not be able to work because of neuropathy or other complications of diabetes. So they'll have lost wages, lost productivity. We could easily estimate that number to be more like $1 million over the course of half of that patient's lifetime. So let's imagine that patient instead went to a doctor when he or she still had prediabetes. They caught it, and then they spent, let's just say, $5,000. That would cover lots of health coaching. It would cover maybe a month or two of groceries. It would cover even some initial testing and 6 months of a gym membership and a personal trainer. Let's even say $10,000. Let's be just generous. We could spend $10,000, the healthcare system could spend $10,000 doing that for 6 months. We could reverse prediabetes, take them back to normal blood sugar level so that they would never progress to full-fledged type 2 diabetes, and then thus saving the healthcare system $990,000 over the course of that patient's lifetime. And this is 100% plausible. If a patient comes to me with prediabetes, I'm virtually certain if they carry through with the recommendations I make that I can reverse that, and so that they don't progress to type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is a totally preventable condition. So I think we just need to step back and rearrange our priorities, and we would see that if we did that, we could not only would it not be more expensive to have the kind of healthcare system that I just described? It would be far, far less expensive over time.
I love that math, because I think that when it comes to explaining just how expensive chronic disease is on the economy in general, like that's not even thinking about indirect healthcare costs like lost wages from sick days, or inability to hold down a job, and how that can affect an individual's ability to then, you know, purchase items, right, and feed the economy that way. And to be able to just go like, look, this when you look at the math, it's a real no-brainer if we can actually give people the resources they need to make these changes, give them the guidance to make these changes, and then follow up and continue to tinker with a doctor who is also seeing a much reasonable number of patients so they can actually have a rapport with each one of them, how much that could change. Think about how much that could even just change, not just the health, you know, the burden on the healthcare system, but how much that could change individuals' lives and how much that could change productivity in the workplace and how much that could change family dynamics, right? And mental health. And like it starts to balloon, not out of control, but in control, right? And it yeah. becomes this, you know, here we've got this one solution to this one problem that could actually, as an aside, as a side effect, provide solutions to multiple issues that we're facing as a country that are going to need solutions in the not too distant future.
That's right. That's very well said. It's a virtuous cycle rather than a vicious cycle. And there are a lot of parallels with functional medicine that are interesting, because in functional medicine, you often see unrelated complaints improve spontaneously. That's your side effect. So for example, if I treat a patient with gut issues, their skin problem clears up and they start thinking more clearly because of this connection between the gut and the brain and the skin. So you have these positive side effects. And that's the same thing that you were just saying, Sarah, where if we make these changes, it's not only going to reduce the cost of care for individuals and organizations and the government, it's not only going to reduce the burden of chronic disease and improve people's quality of life directly because of that, but it's going to have several ripple effects that will, you know, everything from, you know, improving people's relationships and family dynamics because they don't have the stress and burden of chronic disease, which can really be a tremendous burden on families. It's going to, you know, improve the health of communities because more people will be employed and able to work in a productive way. And it's going to improve the health of our society at large because we won't be spending up to 25%, by some estimates, if you include indirect costs, of our GDP on healthcare expenditures. We spend $3.2 trillion a year now on healthcare. That's $10,000 for every man, woman, and child in the U.S. and a third of the median personal income. So this is a substantial drain on all of our resources, financial and otherwise. So that's, you know, part of what I'm hoping to do with this book is just to raise awareness about how significantly this is impacting us. Because I think, for better or for worse, human beings are very adaptable. So we become accustomed to what our, you know, new normal is. But as I've said before in other contexts, there's a very big difference between what's common and what's normal. It's not normal for humans to have chronic disease. We've become accustomed to it because everybody we know, you know, everyone is touched by it, either themselves or a family member or a friend or their children. But it's not normal, and we need to stop accepting chronic disease as if it's just our fate, and we need to get back to the understanding that health is our birthright and health is the natural state for human beings if we do the right things and have access to the right kind of care.
I don't know. Here as well. I don't know if you ever heard Angela Coppola's tagline, "We're not broken by default." It was also one of the things that I originally remember like hearing and learning when I first started this whole ancestral lifestyle approach. And it was one of the things that really stuck with me. And even in kind of Lauren Cordain's book, when he talked about Syndrome X and like all of the stuff being preventable, the way that you're talking about it with diabetes, I think that concept is one that was so powerful for me as someone who was morbidly obese and experiencing so many of the health conditions. And, you know, Sarah and I both were on all kinds of medications and being told that it's normal for, you know, high blood pressure and acid reflux and sleep apnea and all these things. And then suddenly when you remove inflammation, poof, all that stuff is gone. And it's like, well, no, it's not normal. It's common. And so this idea of teaching others, teaching those of conventional approach, that while they might see it all the time, that doesn't mean that it's okay. And that's not to say that 100% of people are going to see 100% improvement from just food and lifestyle. I do want to caveat that there are some people, some of our listeners, you know, when we go to book signings or whatever, they're like, I'm doing all these things and I'm just not, you know, getting where I want to be. Sometimes it's just not enough. And I don't think any of us are advocating that, you know, that's the entirety. But I do think that that is something that could be so powerful if the first question wasn't, you know, well, what medications are you allergic to so I know what to prescribe you? You know, it's like, well, let's look at the root cause. And, you know, what's, I think, fascinating for me, I love that you brought up the statistics, because I loved the numbers and the information in the chapter 6 of your book, talking about how conventional medicine has affected healthcare providers and how disillusioned or frustrated they are with the whole thing. And I think, you know, it's such a powerful statement when you were talking about doctors being with patients an average of 8 minutes. Like even when we watch TV from, you know, 40, 50 years ago, there's like doctors are making house calls and, you know, women were giving birth at home and that was normal. And then you look at, you know, what happens today and how much more inflated costs are. And, you know, I was reminded today by going to the doctors that the first office that we went to like an urgent care because I didn't want to deal with an ER and an overinflated bill from that. And so we went to an urgent care place that would have an x-ray machine. And the first one that we went to, I have good health insurance. Like I have a 9-to-5 job with a large corporate healthcare plan. And the lady was like, oh, we don't take this insurance. You can pay out of pocket. I was like, why would I have insurance if I was going to pay out of pocket? Like that's,
yeah.
And I, you know, I don't know if that's something that people think about, because when you were talking about, well, insurance costs are only indicative of healthcare costs. Like, I don't know that that's something that really people have fully thought through, you know, because I think most people are so separated from, well, the insurance costs are associated with my company and, you know, they work with the healthcare companies and, you know, blah, 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 yada, 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 how the cheese is made, how the sausage is made, actual healthcare costs. And it is, you know, just mind blowing to think about how all of that stuff affects and is inflated. And, you know, at the same time that I'm frustrated that, you know, so and so won't take my insurance, or, you know, such and such isn't covered. And the, you know, once I went to a hospital and the doctor who saw me wasn't in my network, and I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? But at the same time, you've got people who really want to help or whatever. And so it's like, how do you get to, I think where at least America needs to be, is how do you get people to understand that there's a difference between maintenance and lifestyle and things that are actually preventable, that you could work with a knowledgeable practitioner, whether it be conventional or functional, if really they're using a full preventative lifestyle approach, it should be one and the same. But let's just say, how do we get people to understand that there are two sides to that coin? There's the place that you go to when, you know, you have a broken arm, and then there's the place that you go to when you're trying to get your health conditions in check so that you don't need to go on statins, which we all know isn't going to do anybody any good. But
yeah. Well, I think it's even for us, because we know there's a way that the system has been for as long as we've been alive, and that's the only one we know, and it's hard for us to envision something different. But health insurance as a model of, as a method of paying for health care has not been has only been around since, or really prevalent since after World War II. So there was a tax thing passed at that time where it was, you know, a tax break for companies that provided healthcare for employees, and that small little tax, you know, legislation led to health insurance being the primary method of paying for care. But before that, it wasn't. People paid for more of their own healthcare, and you know, one argument for that is that there are lots. I don't actually even know where I stand on this. So, you know, it's such a complex and difficult issue. But there are some people who advocate for a system where, you know, catastrophic, you know, anything that, you know, acute stuff would be covered, whereas more stuff that's related to, you know, more chronic, you know, diet, lifestyle, behavior would not be. And I don't know if that's the right approach, but what's interesting about that is it if people are responsible for covering the costs of those kinds of things, then they might there might be a different calculus, you know, in terms of what the choice is. There's an example that in a book called Catastrophic Care that I included in my book, where the author is doing kind of a thought experiment. He's saying, okay, so I go into the doctor and I've got high cholesterol, and the doctor says, okay, you've got a choice. I could give you this statin drug and it's going to lower your cholesterol and your insurance company's going to pay for that. Or I can, you know, you can change your diet and exercise more. And more, you know, you're on your own. You're not only on your own in terms of the effort involved and the support that you need, but you're on your own in terms of paying for all that. And that's presented to the patient as if it's an equivalent choice, right? Like as if taking a statin, even if it leads to the same reduction of a number on a piece of paper, the cholesterol, you know, it's presented as if that has the same health benefit as doing, you know, exercising and eating, right? Which is, of course, preposterous, but that's the way it's presented. And if it's presented that way to the patient and the statin is reimbursed, why would they not do that? I mean, that's like, you know, we're hardwired to conserve energy and resources. So of course we're going to make that choice. But I think that, like I said before, you know, there's an easier way where we educate patients. We spend more than 3% of our healthcare expenditures on public health initiatives. That's how much we spend now, compared to 86% treating chronic disease. We have more programs like the Cleveland Clinic. We have more books like the one that I just wrote, and we have more and more people who are realizing the shortcomings of conventional medicine to deal with chronic illness. And, you know, over time, there's a growing recognition that this, you know, diet, lifestyle, and behavior change are the key to preventing and reversing chronic disease. Or, like I said before, we get to a point where it's just simply not sustainable any longer. And the system, which is already precarious, as you pointed out, Stacey, and everybody has you know, stories like yours, it just starts becoming patently obvious that it's not going to work the way that we've been doing it. And then people are forced to find another way. And I really believe that when people do have to find another way, they will. You know, people are resourceful, and they, especially when they need to, you know, when they're on their own, or they're forced to go outside of that system, they, you know, they'll naturally find their way. So,
I didn't even tell you about how I waited on an MRI for my back and jumped through 5,000 hoops for insurance approval. And then I got the bill, and it was something that I had to pay as part of my deductible completely out of pocket anyway. So yeah. I'm a little bit, it has nothing to do with political. It's just like, I've experienced it because I have regular insurance and I'm dealing with a regular system, and it's frustrating for sure. So I think not to completely disillusion people, I will just kind of give some recommendations and options for those people who are in my boat, because I know you and Sarah are operating in more of a functional approach, which I think is fantastic and the ideal place to go. I have not been able to wrap my head around that because it's not, my insurance is provided no matter what through my company, right? So it's like, okay, how do I make the best of the situation? And also I have three boys ages 7 to 12, and it's like the minute that I choose to, you know, invest all of that health dollars into an FSA account is going to be the day that all three of them break a bone all in the same month. Like, it's just inevitable. So
yeah, no, I mean, that's why that system of like having insurance for issues like that is should always probably be part of the picture. Nobody wants to be in that situation, but what happens, you know, if your kids have a stuffy, you know, a chronic stuffy nose, is, you know, what's the best option there?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think what's been interesting, I'm part of kind of a local group here of a lot of women who are in the same kind of situation. And what a lot of them are doing is opting into, most companies now offer a kind of health plan that has a really low monthly fee, but more high deductibles. And it is basically contributing, let's say, dollar to dollar up to a certain amount for you to put into like this health bank. And it's a little different than FSA. And that plan is one that they're doing because they're enabled to utilize that money to any practitioner, whether they have health insurance or not, or whether they accept health insurance or not. So if you looked into a plan like this, you would be able to utilize that set aside, quote unquote, insurance money and apply it to different kinds of things like functional medicine, or even in some cases, you know, chiropractic, acupuncture, just natural and holistic healthcare in general. And then also, you can use an FSA account for things like lifestyle, like gym memberships and whatever. So there is on the, you know, I know we've talked a lot about on the downside, and I think from your approach in your book, trying to get more conventional doctors on board, if in the meantime, people are looking for those practitioners who will work with them on the things like taking the rock out of the shoe and chronic nose issues and that kind of stuff, there are ways to do that with more traditional plans, I think. And because we're just not going to change the system overnight. But like you said, when people start putting their money towards things and they figure out how to be resourceful and they start funding things in a different way, people start paying attention. And then maybe those practitioners who are more conventional will say, hey, I need to do what this person's doing because that's where the money is going. So,
yeah. I mean, the message of the book is overwhelmingly positive. There's certainly a lot of challenges that we face, but there are already some really encouraging developments, like I mentioned earlier. And there's a lot that individuals and small groups, like you mentioned, Stacey, that can do to address their own health issues and their family's health issues without even interacting with the medical system at all. I mean, that's really where it's at, right? It's and we haven't talked about this much on this call, but a really well-trained health coach who understands evidence-based principles of behavior change and positive psychology and motivational interviewing and a lot of techniques that have been shown to really promote long-lasting and meaningful behavior change in the formation of healthy habits could probably work with like 70% of the population. You know, most, even though chronic disease is common, in many cases it's not life-threatening and doesn't even necessarily require medical intervention if the patient gets the diet, lifestyle, and behavior dialed in. And we don't necessarily need doctors to do that. Health coaches, skilled health coaches and nutritionists can play a big role in that respect. And I think that we're really underutilizing them currently, and that, you know, that's starting to change. It's one of the reasons I'm launching, in addition to my practitioner training program, a health coach training program next year, because there just never will be enough doctors, even in a functional kind of medicine model, to address the chronic disease epidemic. And the good news is that we don't need doctors to always be the person that's doing that kind of work. And in fact, you could argue they're not the best people to work with patients on the level of diet, behavior, and lifestyle change, because we need doctors to keep doing doctory things, you know, like endoscopies and colonoscopies and removing cancerous tumors and working within their scope of practice. But we can train many, many more, orders of magnitude more health coaches and nutritionists that can still make a very meaningful and you know, significant impact on patients' lives.
I think that's an amazing positive note to end on. I wanted to remind our listeners that Chris Kresser's new book is called Unconventional Medicine: Join the Revolution to Reinvent Healthcare, Reverse Chronic Disease, and Create a Practice You Love. But it's definitely got tons of amazing information out there for people in the medical field, but also, you know, users, so patients as well. And it comes out November 7th. Please go pre-order. And Chris, thank you so much for joining us. This was a really fascinating conversation. I think one that it's a topic that we don't touch on this podcast all that often, but I think it's something that's very, very relevant to our listeners. And we just always love your approach in everything you do. So thanks for coming and sharing that with us today.
Thank you both for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I just love the message that you guys both put out there and your reasoned and rational approach, which is, as you said, very welcome in a community that is not always that way.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Paleo View. If you'd like to check out Chris's book, Unconventional Medicine, you can use the link in our show notes. Of course, that supports our blogs, and we sincerely appreciate that and allows this podcast to remain free of commercials for you. As well, you can find him at chriskresser.com. And thank you for tuning in. We'll be back again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
I feel like whenever we have a guest, this happens, and not normally. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Or when it's the latest possible day that we can record that week's podcast.
Exactly.
And there's no time to do any kind of makeup. Yes. Those are the two occasions where Skype goes up to shenanigans. I can tell you I fell in love with a stray cat and I'm feeding him.
Sarah, I just snorted. You're like, I can't tell you. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what's she going to tell me? And then you're like, I'm feeding a stray cat. I think you've got a lot going on right now. Do you really think that adopting a stray cat's a good life choice?